Welcome back to the Book Club Commune with me, your host, Ivy Poeasy. Today we're going to be finishing up On Guerrilla Warfare by Mao Zedong. It's a bit of a long one just because it's a lot of pages and this text is very condensed. Lots of words on little pages, so, you know, it's a bit to get through. This will be the last work of Mao that I'm reading. I'm going to move on to a new author. I'm not sure who yet, but I'll mention that at the end. So, without further ado, let's finish up On Guerrilla Warfare. Organization for Guerrilla Warfare. 4 points must be considered under this subject. These are: how are guerrilla bands formed? How are guerrilla bands organized? What are the methods for arming guerrilla bands? What elements constitute a guerrilla band? These are all questions pertaining to the organization armed guerrilla units. They are questions which those who had no experience in guerrilla hostilities do not understand, and on which they can arrive at no sound decisions. Indeed, they would not know in what manner to begin. How guerrilla units are originally formed. The unit may originate in one of any of the following ways. A. From the mass of the people. B. From the regular army units temporarily detailed for the purpose. C. From regular army units permanently detailed. D. From the combination of a regular army unit and a unit recruited from the people. E. From the local militia. F. From deserters from the ranks of the enemy. And G. From former bandits and bandit groups. In the present hostilities, no doubt, all these sources will be employed. In the first case above, the guerrilla unit is formed from the people. This is a fundamental type. Upon the arrival of the enemy army to oppress and slaughter the people, their leaders call upon them to resist. They assemble the most valorous elements, arm them with old rifles, or whatever firearms they can, and thus a guerrilla unit begins. Orders have already been issued throughout the nation that call upon the people to form guerrilla units both for local defense and for other combat. If the local government approve and aid such movements, they cannot fail to prosper. In some places where the local government is not determined, or where its officers have all fled, the leaders among the masses, relying on the sympathy of the people and their sincere desire to resist Japan and succor the country, call upon the people to resist, and they respond. Thus, many guerrilla units are organized. In circumstances of this kind, the duties of leadership usually fall upon the circumstances of young students, teachers, professors, or other educators, local soldiery, professorial men, artisans, and those without a fixed position, who are willing to exert themselves to the last drop of their blood. Recently, in Shanxi, Hope, Shahar, Suiyan, Shantung, Chekang, Anhui, Kangsu, and other provinces, extensive guerrilla hostilities have broken out. All these are organized and led by patriots. The amount of such activity is the best proof for the foregoing statement. The more such bands there are, the better the situation will be. Each district, each country, should be able to organize a great number of guerrilla squads, which, when assembled, form a guerrilla company. There are those who say, "I am a farmer," or "I am a student. I can discuss literature, but not the military arts." This is incorrect. There is no profound difference between the farmer and the soldier. You must have courage. You simply leave your farms and become soldiers. That you are farmers is of no difference, and if you have education, that is so much the better. When you take your arms in hands, you become soldiers. When you are organized, you could become military units. Guerrilla hostilities are the universities of war, and after you have fought several times, valiantly and aggressively, you may become the leader of troops, and there will be many well-known regular soldiers who will not be your peers. Without question, the fountainhead of guerrilla warfare is in the masses of the people, who organize guerrilla units directly from themselves. The second type of guerrilla unit is organized from small units of regular forces temporarily detached for the purpose. For example, Since hostilities commenced, many groups have been temporarily detached from the armies, divisions, and brigades, and have been assigned guerrilla duties. A regiment of the regular army may, if circumstances warrant, be dispersed into groups for the purpose of carrying on guerrilla operations. As an example of this, there is the 8-Route Army in North China. Excluding the periods when it carries on mobile operations as an army, it is divided into its elements, and these carry on guerrilla hostilities. This type of guerrilla unit is essential for two reasons. First, in mobile warfare situations, the coordination of guerrilla activities with regular operations is necessary. Second, until guerrilla hostilities can be developed on a grand scale, there is no one to carry out guerrilla missions but regulars. Historical experience shows us that regular army units are not able to undergo the hardship of guerrilla campaigning over long periods. The leaders of regular units engaged in guerrilla operations must be extremely adaptable. They must study the methods of guerrilla war. They must understand that initiative, discipline, and the employment of stratagems are all of the utmost importance. As the guerrilla status of the regular units is but temporary, the leaders must lend all possible support to the organization of guerrilla units from among the people. These units must be so disciplined that they hold together after the departure of the regulars. The third type of unit consists of a detachment of regulars who are permanently assigned to guerrilla duties. This type of small detachment does not have to be prepared to rejoin the regular forces. Its post is somewhere in the rear of the enemy, and there it becomes the backbone of guerrilla organization. As an example of this type of organization, we may take the Wutat Shan district in the heart of the Hope Chahar Shanxi area. Along the borders of these provinces, units from the 8th Route Army have established a framework of guerrilla operations. Around these small corps, many detachments have been organized, and the area of guerrilla activity greatly expanded. In areas in which there is a possibility of cutting the enemy's lines of supply, the system should be used. Severing enemy supply routes destroys his lifeline. This is one feature that cannot be neglected. If at the time the regular forces withdraw from a certain area, some units left behind, these should conduct guerrilla operations in the enemy's rear. As an example of this, we have the guerrilla bands now continuing their independent organized operations in the Shanghai Wusong area, in spite of the withdrawal of regular forces. The fourth type is the result of the merger between the small and regular detachments and the local guerrilla units. The regular forces may dispatch a squad, a platoon, or a company, which is placed at the disposal of the local guerrilla commander. If a small group experienced in military and political affairs is sent, it becomes the core of the local guerrilla unit. These several methods are all excellent, and if properly applied, the intensity of guerrilla warfare can be extended. In the Wutat Shan area, each of these methods has been used. The fifth type mentioned above is from local militia, from police and home guards. In every North China province, there are now many of these groups, and they should be formed in every locality. The government has issued mandate to the effect that the people who are not to depart from the war areas, the officer in command of the county, the commander of the peace preservation unit, the chief of police, are all required to obey this mandate. They cannot retreat with their forces, but must remain at their stations and resist. The sixth type of unit is that organized from troops that come from over the enemy, the Chinese trader troops employed by the Japanese. It is always possible to produce disaffection in their ranks, and we must increase our propaganda efforts and foment mutinies among such troops. Immediately after mutiny, they must be received into our ranks and organized. The concord of the leaders and the assent of the men must be gained, and the units rebuilt politically and reorganized militarily. Once this has been accomplished, they become successful guerrilla units. In regard to this type of unit, it may be said that political work among them is of utmost importance. The seventh type of a guerrilla organization is that formed from bands of bandits and brigands. This, although difficult, must be carried out with utmost vigor, lest the enemy use such bandits to his own advantage. Many bandit groups pose anti-Japanese guerrillas, and it is only necessary to correct their political beliefs to convert them. In spite of inescapable differences in the fundamental types of guerrilla bands, it is possible to unite them and form a vast sea of guerrillas. The ancients said, Taishan is a great mountain because it does not scorn the merest handful of dirt. The rivers, the seas, are deep because they absorb the waters of small streams. Attention paid to the enlistment and organization of guerrillas of every type and from every source will increase the potentialities of guerrilla action in the anti-Japanese war. This is something that patriots will not neglect. The method of organizing guerrilla regimes. Many of those who decide to participate in guerrilla activities do not know the method of organization. For such people, as well as for students who have no knowledge of military affairs, the matter of organization is a problem that requires solution. Even among those who have military knowledge, there are some who know nothing of guerrilla regimes. There are some who know nothing of guerrilla regimes use. They are lacking in that particular type of experience. The subject of the organization of such regimes is not confined to the organization of specific units, but includes all guerrilla activities within the area where the regimes function. As an example of such organization, we may take a geographical area in the enemy's rear. This area may be compromised, may comprise many counties. It must be subdivided in individual companies or battalions formed to accord with the subdivisions. To this military area, a military commander and political commissioner are appointed. Under these, the necessary officers, both military and political, are appointed. In the military headquarters, they will be the staff, the aides, the supply officers, and the medical personnel. These are controlled by the chief of staff, who act in accordance with the orders from the commander. In the political headquarters, there are bureaus of propaganda organization, people's mass movements, and miscellaneous affairs. Controls of these is vested in the political chairman. The military areas are subdivided into smaller districts in accordance with local geography, the enemy's situation locally, and the state of guerrilla development. Each of these smaller divisions within the area is a district, each of which may consist from 2 to 6 counties. To each district, a military commander and several political commissioners are appointed. Under the direction, military and political headquarters are organized. The tasks are assigned in accordance with the number of guerrilla troops available. Although the names of the officers in the district correspond to those in the larger area, the number of the functionaries assigned in the former case should be reduced to the least possible. In order to unify control to handle guerrilla troops that come from different sources, and to harmonize military operations and local political affairs, a committee from 7 to 9 members should be organized in each area and district. The committee, the members of which are selected by the troops and the local political officers, should function as a forum for the discussion of both military and political matters. All the people in the area should arm themselves and organize into 2 groups. One of these groups is a combat group, the other is a self-defense unit, but with limited military quality. Regular combatant guerrillas are organized into 1 of 3 general types of units. The first of these is the small unit, the platoon or company. In each county, 3 to 6 units may be organized. The second type is the battalion, of from 2 or 4 companies. 1 such unit should be organized in each county. While the unit fundamentally belongs to the county it was organized, it may operate in other counties. While in areas other than its own, it must operate in conjunction with local units in order to take advantage of their manpower, their knowledge of local terrain and local customs, and the information of the enemy. The third type is the guerrilla regiment, which consists of from 2 to 4 of the above-mentioned battalion units. If sufficient manpower is available, a guerrilla brigade from two or four regimes may be formed. Each of the unit has its own peculiarities of organization. A squad, the smallest unit, has the strength of from 9 to 11 men, including the leaders and the assistant leader. Its arms may be from 2 to 5 Western-style rifles, with the remaining men armed with rifles of local manufacture, fowling pieces, etc., spears, or big swords. 2 to 4 such squads form a platoon. This, too, has a leader and assistant leader, and when acting independently, it is assigned a political officer to carry on political propaganda work. The platoon may have about 10 rifles, with the remainder of its 4 of such units from a company, which, like the platoon, has a leader and an assistant leader, and a political officer. All these units are under the supervision of the military commanders of the area in which they operate. The battalion unit must be thoroughly organized and better equipped than the smaller units. Its discipline and personnel should be superior. If a battalion is formed from company units, it should not deprive subordinate units entirely of their manpower and their arms. If in small areas there is a peace preservation corps, a branch of the militia, or police, regular guerrillas should not be dispersed over it. The guerrilla unit next in size to the battalion is the regiment. This must be under more severe discipline than the battalion. In an independent guerrilla regiment, there may be 10 men per squad, 3 squad per platoon, 3 platoon per company, 3 company per battalion, and 3 battalions to each regiment. 2 of such regiments form a brigade. Each of these units has a commander, a vice commander, and a political officer. In North China, guerrilla cavalry units should be established. These may be regiments from 2 to 4 companies or battalions. All these units from the lowest to the highest are combatant guerrilla units and receive their supplies from the central government. Details of their organization are shown in the tables. All the people of both sexes from the ages of 16 to 45 must be organized into anti-Japanese self-defense units, the basis of which is voluntary service. As a first step, they must procure arms. Then they must be given both military and political training. Their responsibilities are local sentry duties, securing information from the enemy, arresting traitors, and preventing the dissemination of enemy propaganda. When the enemy launches a guerrilla suppression drive, these units, armed with what weapons they are assigned to certain areas to deceive, hinder, and harass them. Thus, the defense units assist the combatant guerrillas. They have other functions. They furnish stretcher bearers to transport the wounded, carriers to take the food to the troops, and comfort missions to provide the troops with tea and rice. If a locality can organize such a self-defense unit as we have described, the traitors cannot hide, nor can bandits or robbers disturb the peace of the people. Thus, the people will continue to assist the guerrillas and supply manpower to our regular armies. The organization of self-defense units is a transitional step in the development of the universal conscription. Such units are reservoirs of manpower for the Orthodox forces. There have been such organizations from time to time in Shaanxi, Shenzi, Honan, and Suiyan. The youth organizations in different provinces were formed for the purpose of educating the young. They have been of some help. However, they were not voluntary, and confidence of the people was thus not gained. These organizations were not widespread, and their effect was almost negligible. The system was, therefore, supplanted by the new type organizations, which are organized on the principles of voluntary cooperation and non-separation of the members from their native localities. When the members of these organizations are in native towns, they support themselves. Only in cases of military necessity are they ordered to remote places, and when this is done, the government must support them. Each member of these groups must have a weapon, even if the weapon is only a knife, a pistol, a lance, or a spear. In all places where the enemy operates, these self-defense units should organize within themselves a small guerrilla group of perhaps 3 to 10 men armed with pistols or revolvers. This group is not required to leave its native locality. The organization of self-defense units is mentioned in this book because such units are useful for the purpose of inculcating the people with military and political knowledge. keeping order in the rear, and replenishing the ranks of the regulars. These groups should be organized not only in the active war zones, but in every province in China. The people must be inspired to cooperate voluntarily. We must not force them, for if we do, we will be ineffectual. This is extremely important. In order to control anti-Japanese military organization as a whole, it is necessary to establish a system of military areas and districts along the lines we have indicated. Equipment of the guerrillas. In regard to the problem of guerrilla equipment, it must be understood that guerrillas are lightly armed attack groups, which require simple equipment. A standard of equipment is based upon the nature of duties assigned. The equipment of low-class guerrilla units is not as good as that of higher-class units. For example, those who are assigned to the task of destroying rail communications are better equipped than those who do not have that task. The equipment of guerrillas cannot be based on what the guerrillas want, to even what they need, but must be based on what is available for their use. Equipment cannot be furnished immediately, but must be acquired gradually. These are points to be kept in mind. The question of equipment includes the collection of supply and distribution and replacement of materials, ammunition, blankets, communication materials, transport, and facilities for propaganda work. The supply of weapons and ammunition is most difficult, particularly at the time the unit is established, but this problem can be solved eventually. Guerrilla bands that originate in the people are furnished with revolvers, pistols, rifles, spears, big swords, and landmines, and mortars of local manufacture. Other elementary weapons are added, as many new type rifles as are available are distributed. After a period of resistance, it is possible to increase the supply of equipment by capturing it from the enemy. In this respect, the transportation companies are the easiest to equip. For in any successful attack, we will capture the enemy's transport. An armory should be established in each guerrilla district for the manufacture and repair of rifles, and for the production of cartridges, hand grenades, and bayonets. Guerrillas must not depend too much on an armory. The enemy is the principal source of their supply. For the destruction of railway tracks and bridges and stations in enemy-controlled territory, it is necessary to gather together demolition materials. Troops must be trained in the preparation and use of demolitions, and a demolition unit must be organized in each regiment. As for the minimum clothing requirements, these are that each man shall have at least 2 summer weight uniforms, 1 suit of winter clothing, 2 hats, a pint of wrapped puttees, and blanket. Each man must have a pack or bag for food. In the north, each man must have an overcoat. Acquiring this clothing, we cannot depend on the captures made by the enemy, for it is forbidden for captors to take clothing from their prisoners. In order to maintain high morale in guerrilla forces, all the clothing and equipment mentioned should be furnished by the representatives of the government in each guerrilla district. These men may confiscate clothing from traders or ask contributions from those best able to afford them. In subordinate groups, uniforms are unnecessary. Telephone and radio equipment is not necessary in lower grades, but all units from regiment up are equipped with both. This material can be obtained by contributions from the regular forces and by capture from the enemy. In the guerrilla army in general, at the bases in particular, there must be high standards of medical equipment. Besides the services of the doctors, medicines must be procured. Although guerrillas can depend on the enemy for some portion of their medical supplies, they must in general depend upon contributions. If Western medicines are not available, local medicines must be made to suffice. The problem of transport is more vital in North China than in the South, for in the South, all that are necessary are mules and horses. Small guerrilla units need no animals, but regiments and brigades will find them necessary. Commanders and staff of units from companies up should be furnished with a riding animal each. At times, 2 officers will have to share a horse. Officers whose duties are minor nature do not have to be mounted. Propaganda materials are very important. Every large unit should have a printing press and a mimeograph stone. They must have a paper on which to print propaganda leaflets and notices. They must be supplied with large brushes. In guerrilla areas, there should be a printing press or a lead-type press. For the purpose of printing training instructions, this material is of the greatest importance. In addition to the military equipment listed above, it is necessary to have field glasses, compasses, and military maps. An accomplished guerrilla group will acquire these things. Because of the proved importance of guerrilla hostilities in the anti-Japanese war, the headquarters of the nationalist government, and the commanding officers of the various war zones should do their best to supply the guerrillas with what they actually need and are unable to get for themselves. However, it must be repeated that the guerrilla equipment will in the main be dependent on the efforts of the guerrillas themselves. If they depend on higher officers too much, the psychological effort will be to weaken the guerrilla spirit of resistance. Elements of the guerrilla army. The term element, as used in the title of this section, refers to the personnel, both officers and men, of the guerrilla army. Since each guerrilla group fights in a protracted war, its officers must be brave and positive men whose entire loyalty is decided and dedicated to the cause of the emancipation of the people. An officer should have the following qualities: great powers of endurance, so that in spite of any hardship, he sets an example to his men and be a model for them. He must be able to mix easily with the people. His spirit and that of the men must be one in strengthening the policy of resistance to the Japanese. If he wishes to gain victories, he must study tactics. A guerrilla group with officers of this caliber would be unbeatable. I do not mean that every guerrilla can have, in its inception, officers of such qualities. The officers must be men, naturally endowed with good qualities, which can be developed during the course of the campaigning. The most important natural quality is that of complete loyalty to the idea of the people's emancipation. If this is present, the others will develop. If it is not present, nothing can be done. When the officers are first selected from the group, it is this quality that should receive particular attention. The officers in a group should be inhabitants of the locality in which the group is organized, as this will facilitate relations between them and the local civilians. In addition, officers so chosen would be familiar with conditions. If in any locality there are not enough men of sufficient high qualifications to become officers, an effort must be made to train and educate the people so that these qualities may be developed and the potential officer material increased. There could be no disagreements between officers native to one place and those from other localities. Guerrilla group ought to operate on the principle that only volunteers are acceptable for service. It is a mistake to impress people into service. As long as a person is willing to fight, his social condition or position is no consideration. But only men who are courageous and determined can bear the leadership and hardship of guerrilla campaigning in a protracted war. A soldier who habitually breaks regulation must be dismissed from the army. Vagabonds and vicious people must not be accepted for service. The opium habit must be forbidden, and a soldier who cannot break himself of the habit should be dismissed. Victory in guerrilla war is conditioned upon keeping the membership pure and clean. It is a fact that during war, the enemy may take advantage of certain people who are lacking in conscience and patriotism and induce them to join the guerrillas for the purpose of betraying them. Officers must therefore continually educate the soldiers and inculcate patriotism in them. This will prevent the success of traitors. Traitors who are in the ranks must be discovered and expelled, and punishment and expulsion meted out to those who have been influenced by them. In all such cases, the officers should summon the soldiers and relate the fact to them, thus arousing their hatred and detestation for the traitors. This procedure will serve as well as a warning to the other soldiers. If an officer is discovered to be a traitor, some prudence must be used in the punishment adjudged. However, the work of eliminating traitors in the army begins with the elimination among the people. Chinese soldiers who have served under puppet governments and bandits who have converted should be welcomed as individuals or as groups. They should be well treated and repatriated, but care should be used during their reorientation to distinguish those who fight, whose idea is to fight the Japanese, from those who may be present for other reasons. The political problems of guerrilla warfare. In Chapter 1, I mentioned the fact that guerrilla troops should have a precise conception of the political goal of the struggle and the political organization to be used in attaining that goal. This means that both organization and discipline of guerrilla troops must be at a high level so that they can carry out the political activities that are the life of both the guerrilla armies and of the revolutionary warfare. First of all, political activities depend upon the indoctrination of both military and political leaders with the idea of anti-Japanism, through them, the idea is transmitted to the troops. One must not feel that he is anti-Japanese merely because he is a member of a guerrilla unit. The anti-Japanese idea must be an ever-present conviction, and if it is forgotten, we may succumb to the temptations of the enemy, or be overcome with discouragement. In a war of long duration, those whose conviction that the people must be emancipated is not deeply rooted are likely to become shaken in their faith or actually revolt. Without the general education that enables everyone to understand our goal of driving out Japanese imperialism and establishing a free and happy China, the soldiers fight without conviction and lose their determination. The political goals must be clearly and precisely indicated to inhabitants of guerrilla zones and their national consciousness awakened. Hence, a concrete explanation of the political systems used is important, not only to guerrilla troops, but to all those who are concerned with the realization of our political goal. The Kuomintang has issued a pamphlet entitled System of National Organization for War, which should be widely distributed throughout guerrilla zones. If we lack national organization, we will lack the essential unity that should exist between the soldiers and the people. A study and comprehension of the political objectives of this war and of the anti-Japanese front is particularly important for officers of guerrilla troops. There are some militarists who say, "We are not interested in politics, but only in the profession of arms." It is vital that these simple-minded militarists be made to realize the relationship that exists between politics and military affairs. Military action is a method used to attain a political goal. While military affairs and political affairs are not identical, it is impossible to isolate from one and the other. It is to be hoped that the world is in the last era of strife. The vast majority of human beings have already prepared or are preparing to fight a war that will bring justice to the oppressed people of the world. No matter how long this war may last, there is no doubt that it will be followed by an unprecedented epoch of peace. The war we are fighting today for the freedom of all human beings and the independent, happy, and liberal China that we are fighting to establish will be part of a new world order. A conception like this is difficult for the simple-minded militarist to grasp, and it therefore must be carefully explained to him. There are the additional matters that must be considered under the broad question of political activities. These are political activities, first as applied to the troops, second as applied to the people, and third as applied to the enemy. The fundamental problems are, first, spiritual unification of officers and men within the army. Second, spiritual unification of the army and the people, of the army and the people. And last, destruction of the unity of the enemy. The concrete methods of achieving these unities are discussed in detail in pamphlet number 4 of the series entitled Political Activities in Anti-Japanese Guerrilla Warfare. A revolutionary army must have discipline that is established on a limited democratic basis. In all armies, obedience the subordinates to their superiors must be exacted. This is true in the case of guerrilla discipline, but what the basis for guerrilla discipline must be the individual conscious. With guerrillas, a discipline of compulsion is ineffective. In any revolutionary army, there is unity of purpose, as far as both officers and men are concerned. And therefore, within such an army, discipline is self-imposed. Although discipline in guerrilla ranks is not as severe in the ranks of the orthodox forces, the necessity for a discipline exists. There must be self-imposed, because only when it is the soldier able to understand completely why he fights and why he must obey. This type of discipline becomes a tower of strength within the army, and is the only type that can truly harmonize the relationship that exists between officers and soldiers. In any system where discipline is externally imposed, the relationship that exists between the officer and man is characterized by indifference of one to the other. The idea that officers can physically beat or severely
tongue lash their men is a futile one, and is not in accord with the conception of self-imposed discipline. Discipline of the feudal type will destroy internal unity and fighting strength. A discipline self-imposed is the primary characteristic of a democratic system in the army. A secondary characteristic is found in the degree of liberties accorded soldiers and officers. In a revolutionary army, all individuals enjoy political liberty, and the question, for example, of the emancipation of the people must not only be tolerated but discussed, and propaganda must be encouraged. Further, in such an army, the mode of living of the officers and the soldiers must not differ too much, and this is particularly true in the case of guerrilla troops. Officers should live under the same conditions as their men, for that is the only way in which they can gain from their men the admiration and confidence so vital in war. It is incorrect to hold to a theory of equality in all things, but there must be an equality of existence in accepting the hardships and dangers of war. Thus we may attain to the unification of the officer and soldier, groups, a unity both horizontal within the group itself and vertical, that is, from the lower to higher echelons. It is only when such unity is present that units can be said to be powerful combat factors. There is also a unity of spirit that should exist between troops and local inhabitants. The Eight-Root Army put into practice a code known as Three Rules and the Eight Remarks, which we list here. Rules. All actions are subjected to command. Do not steal from the people. Be neither selfish nor unjust. Remarks. Replace the door when you leave the house. Roll out the bedding on which you have slept. Be courteous. Be honest in your transactions. Return what you borrow. Replace what you break. Do not bathe in the presence of women. Do not, without authority, search those you arrest. The Red Army adhered to this code for 10 years, and the 8th Army and other units have since adopted it. Many think it is impossible for guerrillas to exist for long in the enemy's rear. Such a belief reveals the lack of comprehension of the relationship that should exist between the people and the troops. The former may be likened to water, the latter to the fish who inhabit it. Who may it be said that these two cannot exist together? It is only undisciplined troops who make the people their enemies, and who, like the fish out of its native element, cannot live. We further our mission of destroying the enemy by propagandizing his troops, by treating his captured soldiers with consideration, and catering for those of his wounded who fall into our hands. If we fail in these respects, we strengthen the solidarity of our enemy. The strategy of guerrilla resistance against Japan. It has been definitely decided that in the strategy of our war against Japan, guerrilla strategy must be auxiliary to fundamental orthodox methods. If this were a small country, guerrilla activities could be carried out close to the scene of operations of the regular army and directly complementary to them. In such a case, there would be no question of guerrilla strategy as such. Nor would the question arise if our country were as strong as Russia, for example, and able speedily to eject the invader. The question exists because China, a weak country of vast size, has today progressed to the point where it has become possible to adopt the policy of a protracted war characterized by guerrilla operations. Although these may at first glance seem to be abnormal or heterodox, such is not actually the case. Because Japanese military power is inadequate, much of her territory her armies have overrun is without sufficient garrison troops. Under such circumstances, the primary functions of guerrilla are three. First, to conduct a war on exterior lines, that is, in the rear of the enemy. Second, to establish bases. And last, to extend the war areas. Thus, guerrilla participation in the war is not merely a matter of purely local guerrilla tactics, but involves strategic considerations. Such war, with its vast time and space factors, establishes a new military process, to the focal point of which is China today. The Japanese are apparently attempting to recall a past that saw the Yuan extinguish the Song and the Qing conqueror, the Ming. That witnessed the extension of the British Empire to North America and India. That saw the Latins overrun Central and South America. As far as China today is concerned, such dreams of conquest are fantastic and without reality. Today's China is better equipped than that was the China of yesterday, and a new type of guerrilla hostilities are part of that equipment. If our enemy fails to take these facts into consideration and makes too optimistic an estimate of the situation, he courts disaster. Though the strategy of guerrillas is inseparable from the war strategy as a whole, the actual conduct of these hostilities differ from the conduct of the orthodox operations. Each type of warfare has methods peculiar to itself, and such methods suitable to regular warfare cannot be applied with success to the special situations that confront guerrillas. Before we treat the practical aspects of guerrilla war, it might be well to recall the fundamental axiom of combat on which all military action is based. This can be stated: conversion of one's own strength, destruction of enemy strength. A military policy based on this axiom is consonant with a national policy directed towards the building of a free and prosperous Chinese state and the destruction of Japanese imperialism. It is in furtherance of this policy that government applies in military strength. Is the sacrifice demanded by war in conflict with the idea of self-preservation? Not at all. The sacrifices demanded are necessary both to destroy the enemy and to preserve ourselves. The sacrifice of part of the people is necessary to preserve the whole. All the considerations of the military action are derived from this axiom. Its application is as apparent in all tactical and strategic conceptions as is the simple case of the soldier who shoots at his enemy from a covered position. All guerrilla units start from nothing and grow. What methods should we select to ensure the conservation and development of our own strength and the destruction of that of the enemy? The essential requirements are the six listed below. Retention of the initiative, alertness, carefully planned tactical attacks in a war of strategic defense, tactical speed in a war strategically protracted, tactical operations on exterior lines in a war conducted strategically on interior lines. Conduct of operations to complement those of the regular army. The establishment of bases. A clear understanding of the relationship that exists between the attack and the defense. The development of mobile operations. Correct command. The enemy, though numerically weak, is strong in the quality of his troops and their equipment. We, on the other hand, are numerically strong, but weak as to quality. These considerations have to be taken into account in the development of the policy of tactical offense, tactical speed, and tactical operations on exterior lines. In a war, that, strategically speaking, is defensive in character, protracted in nature, and conducted along interior lines. Our strategy is based on these conceptions. They must be kept in mind in the conduct of all operations. Although the element of surprise is not absent in orthodox warfare, there are fewer opportunities to apply it than there are during guerrilla hostilities. In the latter, speed is essential. The movements of guerrilla troops must be secret and of supernatural rapidity. The enemy must be taken unaware, and the action entered speedily. There can be no procrastination in the execution of plans, no assumption of a negative or passive defense, no great dispersion of forces in the many local engagements. The basic method is the attack in a violent and deceptive form. While there may be cases where the attack will extend over a period of several days, if that length of time is necessary to annihilate the enemy group, it is more profitable to launch and push an attack with maximum speed. The tactics of defense have no place in the realm of guerrilla warfare. If a delaying action is necessary, such places as defiles, river crossings, and villages offer the most suitable conditions, for it is in such places that the enemy's arrangements may be disrupted and he may be annihilated. The enemy is much stronger than we are, and it is true that we can hinder, distract, disperse, and destroy him only if we disperse our own forces. Although guerrilla warfare is the warfare of such dispersed units, it is sometimes desirable to concentrate in order to destroy an enemy. Thus, the principle of concentration of force against a relatively weaker enemy is applicable to guerrilla warfare. We can prolong the struggle and make of it a protracted war only by gaining positive and lightning-like tactical decisions, by employing our manpower in proper concentration and dispersions, by operation on exterior lines in order to surround and destroy the enemy. If we cannot surround whole armies, we can at least partially destroy him. If we cannot kill the Japanese, we can capture them. The total effect of many local successes will be to change the relative strength of the opposing forces. The destruction of Japan's military power, combined with the international sympathy for China's cause and the revolutionary tendencies evident in Japan, will be sufficient to destroy Japanese imperialism. We will next discuss initiative alertness in the matter of careful planning. What is meant by initiative in warfare? In all battles and wars, a struggle to gain and retain the initiative goes on between the opposing sides, for it is the side that holds the initiative that has liberty of action. When an army loses the initiative, it loses its liberty. Its role becomes passive. It faces the danger of defeat and destruction. It is more difficult to obtain the initiative when defending on interior lines than it is when attacking on exterior lines. This is what Japan is doing. There are, however, several weak points as far as Japan is concerned. One of these is a lack of sufficient manpower for the tasks. Another is her cruelty to the inhabitants of conquered areas. A third is the underestimation of Chinese strength, which has resulted in the differences between military cliques, which in turn have been productive in many mistakes in the direction of her military. For instance, she had been gradually compelled to increase her manpower in China, while, at the same time, the many arguments over plans of operations and disposition of troops have resulted in the loss of good opportunities for improvement of her strategic position. This explains the fact that although the Japanese are frequently able to surround large bodies of Chinese troops, they have never yet been able to capture more than a few. The Japanese military machine is thus being weakened by insufficiency of manpower, stupidity of tactics, inadequacy of resources, and the barbarism of her troops. Her offensive continues unabated, but because of the weakness pointed out, her attack must be limited in extent. She can never conquer China. The day will come, indeed already it has in some areas, when she will be forced into a passive role. When hostilities commenced, China was passive, but as we entered the second phase of the war, we find ourselves pursuing a strategy of mobile warfare, of both guerrilla and regulars operating on exterior lines. Thus, with each passing day, we see some degree of initiative from the Japanese. The matter of initiative is especially serious for guerrilla troops. We must face critical situations unknown to regular troops. The superiority of the enemy and the lack of unity and experience within our own ranks may be cited. Guerrillas can, however, gain the initiative if they keep in mind the weak points of the enemy. Because of the enemy's insufficient manpower, guerrillas can operate over vast territories. Because he is a foreigner and a barbarian, guerrillas can gain the confidence of millions of their countrymen. Because of the stupidity of enemy commanders, guerrillas can make full use of their own cleverness. Both guerrillas and regulars must exploit these enemy weaknesses, while at the same time our own are remedied. Some of our weaknesses are apparent only and are, in actuality, sources of strength. For example, the very fact that most guerrilla groups are small makes it desirable and advantageous for them to appear and disappear in the enemy's rear. With such activities, the enemy is simply unable to cope. A similar liberty of action can rarely be obtained by regular forces. When the enemy attacks the guerrillas with more than one column, it is difficult for the latter to retain the initiative. Any error, no matter how slight, in the estimation of the situation is likely to result in forcing the guerrillas into a passive role. They will then find themselves unable to beat off the attacks of the enemy. It is apparent that we can gain and retain the initiative only by a correct estimation of the situation and proper arrangement of all military and political factors. A too pessimistic estimate will operate to force us into a passive position, with consequent loss of initiative. An overly optimistic estimate, with its rash ordering of factors, will produce the same result. No military leader is endowed by heaven with an ability to seize the initiative. It is her intelligent leader who does so after a careful study, an estimate of the situation, and arrangement of the military and political factors involved. When a guerrilla unit, through either poor estimate on the part of the leader or pressure from the enemy, is forced into passive position, its first duty is to extricate itself. No method can be prescribed for this, as the method to be employed will, in every case, depend on the situation. One can, if necessary, run away. But there are times when the situation seems hopeless, and in reality, it is not so at all. It is at such times that the good leader recognizes and seizes the moment when he can regain the lost initiative. Let us revert to alertness. To conduct one's troops with alertness is an essential of guerrilla command. Leaders must realize that to operate alertly is the most important factor in gaining the initiative and vital in its effects of the relative situation that exists between our forces and those of the enemy. Guerrilla commanders adjust their operations to the enemy, situation, and the terrain, and to prevailing local conditions. Leaders must be alert and sense changes in these factors and make necessary modifications in troop dispositions to accord with them. The leader must be like a fisherman who, with his nets, is able to both cast them and to pull them out in awareness of the depth of the water, the strength of the current, or the presence of any obstructions that may foul them. As the fisherman controls his nets through the lead ropes, so the guerrilla leader maintains contact with control over his units. As the fisherman must change his position, so must the guerrilla commander. Dispersion, concentration, constant change of position. It is these ways that guerrillas employ their strength. In general, guerrillas' units disperse to operate. When the enemy is in overextended defense and sufficient force cannot be concentrated against him, guerrillas must disperse, harass him, and demoralize him. When encircled by the enemy, guerrillas disperse to withdraw. When the nature of the ground limits action, guerrillas disperse. When the availability of supplies limits action, they disperse. And when guerrillas disperse in order to promote mass movements over a wide area. Regardless of the circumstances that prevail at the time of dispersal, caution must be exercised in certain matters. A relatively large group should be retained as a central force. The remainder of the troops should not be divided into groups of absolutely equal size. In this way, the leader is in a position to deal with any circumstances that may arise. Each dispersed unit should have clear and definite responsibilities. Order should specify a place to which to proceed, the time of proceeding, and the place, time, and method of assembly. Guerrillas concentrate on the enemy when the enemy is advancing on them, and there is opportunity to fall upon him and destroy him. Concentration may be desirable when the enemy is on the defensive and the guerrillas wish to destroy isolated detachments in particular localities. By the term concentrate, we do not mean the assembly of all manpower, but rather that of only the necessary for the task. The remaining guerrillas are assigned missions of hindering and delaying the enemy, of destroying isolated groups, or of conducting mass propaganda. In addition to the dispersal and concentration of forces, the leader must understand what is termed alert shifting. When the enemy feels the danger of guerrillas, he will generally send troops out to attack him. The guerrillas must consider the situation and decide at what time and at what place they wish to fight. If they find that they cannot fight, they must immediately shift. Then the enemy may be destroyed piecemeal. For example, after a guerrilla group has destroyed an enemy detachment at one place, it may be shifted to another area to attack and destroy a second detachment. Sometimes it will not be profitable for a unit to become engaged in a certain area, and in that case, it must move immediately. When the situation is serious, the guerrilla must move with fluidity of water and with the ease of the blowing wind. Their tactics must deceive, tempt, and confuse the enemy. They must lead the enemy to believe that they will attack him from the east and north, and then must rapidly strike him from the west and south. They must strike and then rapidly disperse. They must move at night. Guerrilla initiative is expressed in dispersion, concentration, and the alert shifting of forces. If guerrillas are stupid and obstinate, they will lead to the passive positions and severely damaged. Skill in conducting guerrilla operations, however, lies not in merely understanding that the things that we have discussed, but rather in their actual application on the field of battle. The quick intelligence that constantly watches the ever-changing situation and is able to seize on the right moment for decisive action is found only in keen and thoughtful observers. Careful planning is necessary if victory is to be won in guerrilla war, and those who fight without method do not understand the nature of guerrilla action. The plan is necessary regardless of the size of the unit involved, and a prudent plan is necessary in the case of the size of the squad, as in the case of the regiment. The situation must be carefully studied, and then an assignment of duties made. Plans must include both political and military instructions, the matter of supplies and equipment, and the matter of cooperation with local civilians. Without study of these factors, it is impossible to either seize or the initiative or to operate alertly. It is true that guerrillas can only make limited plans, but even so, the factors we have mentioned must be considered. The initiative can be secured and retained only following a positive victory that results from the attack. The attack must be made on guerrilla initiative. That is, guerrillas must not permit themselves to be maneuvered into a position where they are robbed of initiative and where the decision to attack is forced upon them. Any victory will result from carefully planning and alert control. Even in defense, all our efforts must be directed towards a resumption of the attack, for it is only by attack that we can extinguish our enemies and preserve ourselves. A defense or a withdrawal is entirely useless as far as extinguishing our enemies is concerned, and of only temporary value as far as the conservation of our forces is concerned. This principle is valid both for guerrillas and regular troops. The differences are of only degree, that is to say, in the manner of execution. The relationship that exists between guerrillas and the orthodox forces is important and must be appreciated. Generally speaking, there are types of cooperation between guerrillas and orthodox groups. These are strategic cooperation, tactical cooperation, and battle cooperation. Guerrillas who harass enemies' rear installations and hinder his transport are weakening him and encouraging the national spirit of resistance. They are cooperating strategy. For example, the guerrillas in Manchuria had no function of strategical cooperation with orthodox forces until the war in China started. Since that time, their faction of strategic cooperation is evident, for if they can kill one enemy, they make the enemy expend one round of ammunition, or hinder one enemy group in its advance southwards, our powers of resistance here are proportionately increased. Such guerrilla action has a positive action on the enemy nation and on its troops, while at the same time it encourages our own countrymen. Another example of strategic cooperation is furnished by the guerrillas who operate along the Ping Shui, Ping Han, Qipu, Tongpu, and Qingtai railways. The cooperation began when the invader attacked and continued during the period when he held garrisoned cities in the areas, and was intensified when our regular forces counterattacked in an effort to restore the lost territories. An example of tactical cooperation, we may cite the operations of Sing Cao, when guerrillas both north and south of Ye Men destroyed the Tu Pu Railway and the motor roads near Ping Hosing Pass and Yang Fang Cao. A number of small operating bases were established, and organized guerrilla actions in Sanxi complemented the activities of the regular forces, both there and in defense of Honan. Similarly, during the South Shantung Campaign, guerrillas in the five northern provinces cooperated with the army's operation in the Huzhou Front. Guerrilla commanders in the rear and in those in command of regiments assigned to operate with orthodox units must cooperate in accordance with the situation. It is their function to determine weak points in the enemy dispositions, harass them, and disrupt their transport to undermine their morale. If guerrilla action were independent, the results to be obtained from tactical cooperation would be lost and those that result from strategic cooperation greatly diminished. In order to accomplish their mission and improve the degree of cooperation, guerrilla units must be equipped with some means of rapid communication. For this purpose, two-way radio sets are recommended. Guerrilla forces in the immediate battle area are responsible for close cooperation with regular forces. Their principal functions are to hinder enemy transport to gather information and to act as outposts and sentinels. Even without precise instructions from the commander of the regular forces, these missions, as well as any others that contribute to the general success, should be assumed. The problem of establishment of bases is of particular importance. This is so because war is a cruel and protracted struggle. The lost territories can only be restored by counterattack, and this we cannot carry out until the enemy is willing to China. Consequently, some part of our country, or indeed most of it, may be captured by the enemy and become his rear area. It is our task to develop intensive guerrilla warfare over this vast area and convert the enemy's rear into an additional front. Thus, the enemy will never be able to stop fighting. In order to subdue the occupied territory, the enemy will have to become increasingly severe and oppressive. A guerrilla base may be defined as an area strategically located in which the guerrillas can carry out their duties of training, self-preservation, and development. Ability to fight a war without a rear area is a fundamental characteristic of guerrilla action, But this does not mean that gorillas can exist and function over a long period of time without the development of base areas. History shows us many examples of peasant revolts that were unsuccessful, and it is fanciful to believe that such movements characterized by banditry and brigandage can succeed in this era of improved communications and military equipment. Some guerrilla leaders seem to think that these qualities are present in today's movement, and before such leaders can comprehend the importance of base areas in the long-term war, their minds must be disabused of this idea. The subject of bases may be better understood if we consider the various categories of bases, the guerrilla areas and base areas, the establishment of bases, and the development of bases. Guerrilla bases may be classified according to the location as, first, mountain bases, second, plains bases, and last, river, lake, and bay bases. The advantages of bases in mountainous areas are evident. Those which are now established in Changpaoshan, Wu Taishan, Taihengshan, Taishan, Yanshan, and Maoshan. These bases are strongly protected. Similar bases should be established in all enemy rear areas. Plains country is generally not satisfactory for guerrilla operating bases, but this does not mean that guerrilla warfare cannot flourish in such country, or that bases cannot be established here. The extent of guerrilla development in Hopei and West Shantung proves the opposite of these to be the case. Whether we can count on these areas of count on the use of these bases over long periods of time is questionable. We can, however, establish small bases of a seasonal or temporary nature. This we can do because our barbaric enemy simply does not have the manpower to occupy all areas that he has overrun, and because the population of China is so numerous, a base area can be established anywhere. Seasonal bases in the plain country may be established in the winter, when the rivers are frozen over, and the summer, when the crops are growing. Temporary bases may be established when the enemy is otherwise occupied. When the enemy advances, the guerrillas who have established bases in the plains area are the first to engage him. Upon their withdrawal to mountainous country, they should leave behind them guerrilla groups dispersed over the entire area. Guerrillas shift from the base to the base on the theory that they must be in one place one day and another place the next. There are many historical examples of the establishment of bases in river, bay, and lake country, and this is one of the aspects of our activity that has so far received little attention. Red guerrillas held out for many years in the Hongse Lake region. We should establish bases in Hongse and Tai areas, and along areas and watercourses in territory controlled by the enemy, as so to deny him and free use of the water routes. There is a difference between the terms base area and guerrilla area. An area completely surrounded by territory occupied by the enemy is a base area. Wu Taishan and Taihengshan are examples of base areas. On the other hand, the area north and east of Wu Taishan, the Shaanxi-Hopei-Chahar border zone, is a guerrilla area. Such areas can be controlled by guerrillas only while they physically actually occupy them. Upon their departure, control reverts into a puppet pro-Japanese government. East Hopei, for example, was at first a guerrilla area rather than a base area. A puppet government functioned there. Eventually, the people, organized and inspired by guerrillas from the Wutai Mountains, assisted in the transformation of this guerrilla area into a real base area. Such a task is extremely difficult, for it is largely dependent upon the degree to which the zones contiguous to the railways, the guerrillas see unable to drive the Japanese and puppets out. These areas remain guerrilla areas. At other times, the base area might become guerrilla areas, either due to our own mistakes or activities of the enemy. Obviously, in any area in a war zone, any one of three situations may develop. The area may remain in Chinese hands. It may be lost to the Japanese and puppets, or it may be divided between the combatants. Guerrilla leaders should endeavor to see that the first or the last of these situations is assured. Another point essential in the establishment of bases is the cooperation that must exist between the armed guerrilla bands and the people. All our strength must be used to spread the doctrine of armed resistance to Japan, and to arm the people and organize self-defense units. To train guerrilla bands, this doctrine must be spread among the people, who must be organized into anti-Japanese groups. Their political instincts must be sharpened, and their martial ardor increased. If the workers, the farmers, and the lovers of liberty, the young men, the women, and the children are not organized, they will never realize their own anti-Japanese power. Only the united strength of the people can eliminate traitors, recover the measure of political power that has been lost, and conserve and improve what we still retain. We have already touched on geographic factors in our discussion of bases, and we must also mention economic aspects of the problem. What economic policy should be adopted? Any such policy must offer reasonable protection to commerce and business. We must interpret a reasonable protection to mean the people must contribute money in proportion to the money they have. Farmers will be required to furnish a certain share of their crops to guerrilla troops. Confiscation, except in cases of business run by traders, is prohibited. Our activities must be extended over the entire periphery of the base area, if we wish to attack the enemy's bases and thus strengthen and develop our own. This will afford us opportunity to organize, equip, and train the people, thus furthering guerrilla policy, as well as the national policy of protracted war. At times, we must emphasize in the development and extension of the base areas. At other times, the organization, training, or equipment of the people. Each guerrilla base will have its own peculiar problems of attack and defense. In general, the enemy, in an endeavor to consolidate his gains, will attempt to extinguish guerrilla base areas by dispatching numerous bodies of troops over a number of different routes. This must be anticipated and the encirclement broken by counterattacks. As such, enemy columns are without reserves. We should plan on using our main forces to attack one of them by surprise and divert our secondary effort to continual hindrance and harassment. At the same time, other forces should isolate enemy garrison troops and operate on their lines of supply and communication. When one column has been disposed of, we may turn our attention to one of the others. In a base area as large as Wutat Shan, for example, there are 4 or 5 military subdivisions. Guerrillas in these subdivisions must cooperate to form a primary force to counterattack the enemy or the area in which he came, while a secondary force harasses and hinders him. After defeating the enemy in the rear, we must take advantage of the period he requires for reorganization and to press home our attacks. We must not attack an objective we are not certain of winning. We must confine our operations to relatively small areas and destroy the enemy and traitors in those places. When the inhabitants have been inspired, new volunteers accepted training, equipped, and organized, our operations may be extended to include cities and lines of communications not strongly held. We may hold these for at least a temporary, if not permanent, periods. All these are our duties in offensive strategy. Their object is to lengthen the period that the enemy must remain on the defensive. Then our military activities and our organization work among the masses of the people must be zealously expanded. And with equal zeal, the strength of the enemy attacked and diminished, it is of great importance that guerrilla units be rested and instructed. During such times as the enemy is on the defensive, the troops may get some rest and instruction may be carried out. The development of mobile warfare is not only possible but essential. This is the case because our current war is a desperate and protracted struggle. If China were able to conquer the Japanese bandits speedily and to recover her lost territories, there would be no question of long-term war on the national scale. Hence, there would be no question of the relation of guerrilla hostilities into mobile warfare of an orthodox nature. Both the quantity and quality of guerrilla must be improved. Primarily, more men must join the armies. Then the quality of equipment and standards of training must be improved. Political training must be emphasized, and our organization and technique of handling of our weapons, our tactics, all must be improved. Our internal discipline must be strengthened. The soldiers must be educated politically. There must be a gradual change from guerrilla formations to orthodox regimental organization. The necessary bureaus and staff, both political and military, must be provided. At the same time, attention must be paid to the creation of suitable supply, medical, and hygiene units. The standards of equipment must be raised, and types of weapons increased. Communications equipment must not be forgotten. Orthodox standards of discipline must be established. Because guerrilla formations act independently, and because they are most elementary of armed formations, command cannot be too highly centralized. If it were guerrilla action would be too limited in scope. At the same time, guerrilla activities, to be most effective, must be coordinated, not only insofar as they are themselves are concerned, but additionally with regular troops operating in the same areas. This coordination is a function of the war zone commander and his staff. In guerrilla base areas, the commander must be centralized for strategical purposes and decentralized for tactical purposes. Centralized strategical command takes care of the general management of all general units, guerrilla units, their coordination within war zones, and the general policy regarding guerrilla base areas. Beyond this, centralization of command will result in interference with subordinate units, as, naturally, the tactics to apply to concrete situations can be determined only as these various situations arise. This is true in orthodox warfare when communications between the lower and higher echelons break down. In a word, proper guerrilla policy will provide for unified strategy and independent activity. Each guerrilla area is divided into districts, and these in turn are divided into sub-districts. Each subdivision has its appointed commander, and while general plans are made by higher commanders, the nature of actions is determined by inferior commanders. The former may suggest the nature of the action to be taken, but cannot define it. Thus, inferior groups have more or less complete local control. End of On Guerrilla Warfare by Mao Zedong. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Book Club Commune. Like I said, this would be the last work of Mao that we're going to read. I was going to do The Little Red Book, but decided that that wouldn't translate well into an audio format. So I'm just going to skip it. You can read that on your own. It's short. It's a bunch of quotes. Who cares? Which means that the next book I'm going to read is kind of up in the air. I'm either going to do Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific by Frederick Engels, or I'm going to jump back and go do some more classic stuff and do some Lenin, in which I would do What is to be Done, Imperialism, but cut out all of the graphs and shit, because I'm not doing that, State and Revolution, and then probably Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder, and then as a special treat, The Proletarian Revolution and The Renegade Kautsky, because you just have to. So all of those works I'm definitely going to read, whether it's Engels or Lenin that I do next. It just depends on which one I do first. I might do Lenin just to get me through November and December, because when January comes around, I'm probably going to shift gears and go do Fanon and do Wretched of the Earth. My copy of Wretched of the Earth is currently about 2.5 hours away, that I've lent it to someone else, and they won't be back to give it back to me until January. So once I get my copy back, I'm probably going to do Wretched of the Earth. But that remains to be seen on if I get my copy back or not. So until then, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you've enjoyed reading Mao with me. Just thank you all so much. Like I said, like and share this with your comrades. I'm noticing more and more people are listening to this. We've reached over 2,000 plays through all of time. I've been doing this for over a year now. So I really appreciate all of you. It makes, part of it is makes me feel like this is worth it. I would be doing this regardless because it's making me read works that I have been procrastinating reading for a long time. It's good for everyone involved. But as always, solidarity forever, and keep on reading.